Attention, everybody. The views and opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of Axe Ministry, Axe Media Group, and or their affiliate and subordinate ministries and or nonprofits. And this is new. It is not recommended that any children watch this show unattended, as the content may be considered an adult topic. So please, let your kids watch, but be attentive. Now, here he is to talk about terrorism, Dr. Steve Albrecht.
Thanks, Producer Matt. Welcome to Crime Time. This is Crime Time Podcast, episode 66. I'm Dr. Steve Albrecht, joining you from the Axe Media Group Studios in Springfield, Missouri. It is a frosty morning this morning. We're going to talk about terrorism. So for this hour, I'll be talking about terrorism awareness, which is our sense of looking at the possibility of domestic terrorism in this country and international terrorism is always preceded by surveillance and preceded by activities that a reasonable, intuitive person would look at and say, this seems unusual. And we get the whole message from the feds, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security, which is, if you see something, say something. We will talk about what that means. So I will be talking about terrorism awareness and kind of the sense of community and neighborhood that we have to have as we look at this issue. We tend to focus on international terrorism, looking at things that happen overseas, especially in the Middle East and a lot of countries, you know, in Africa and Latin America, where there's a lot of turmoil and tension. But there are just as many domestic terrorist groups in this country, and there are international terrorist groups that recruit and send folks over to here to work and learn and infiltrate, whether it's the Chinese or from Middle Eastern countries and African countries, Latin American countries, where and former Soviet bloc countries, where they send over people to become involved in our American jobs and our American way, and to figure out ways to get information and intelligence information back to their home states, their home countries, where it's part of their terrorist activities to develop information and intelligence about us. So we'll talk about domestic terrorist groups here, international terrorist groups, and we'll look at the 15 warning signs, and there's more, but I have a good list of 15 warning signs for potential terrorist activities that we may see as we go about our daily lives. This includes evidence of surveillance, being watched by groups of people or one or more people, boundary probing, which is testing or being able to get past security, get past security devices, get past security personnel, get past employees into businesses and things like that. And we'll look at aviation surveillance. Drones is a concern these days for people that are using drones for surveillance and also to gather information from a terrorist perspective, how they can use drones to actually drop bombs and things like that, getting to be a concern. Cyber attacks, for sure. This is the intelligent terrorist weapon of choice, which is to come after us, go after our national defense, go after our infrastructure, go after our electronics or our electric power grids and things like that. Certainly, people that are making bombs and storing these things, there's a lot of use of people that rent storage facilities and actually do bomb-making activities in that, and bomb-making activities in apartments and hotels and in houses that sometimes neighbors are going to see things as they walk by, drive by, look in plain view what's going on. And then also diversionary activities or crimes. I'm looking kind of as a diversionary activity as an example of the Christmas Day bombing in Nashville, Tennessee, where this guy who put the bomb inside the RV, warned about what he was going to do and did it, is kind of one of those activities that this may happen at one part of the city and all the resources, paramedics, firefighters, cops, move towards that location in the city, and then the secondary device is set off somewhere else. We've seen that a lot in Europe, where there's more than one device, and the folks at the Irish Republican Army and the IRA struggles in the 60s, 70s, and 80s between the Protestants and the Catholics were the ones that really specialized in that kind of attack, which is one attack which diverts the resources, and then a second attack 5 miles away or 10 miles away, which causes even more chaos. And so we've seen that in Europe as well. One of the things we have not seen, thankfully, so far in the same level of detail and use as we've seen overseas, especially in Europe, is the use of the car as a terroristic device, not necessarily a car bomb, but a car as to run people over. We've seen it in London and other cities, France, those places where folks get run over trying to flee from a terrorist activity, where this person either uses the car, the truck, as a device to kill people or runs over folks and then sets off the bomb inside the car as well. So that's certainly a current concern, vehicle-borne terrorism as well. So we'll talk about how and why we need to continue to be vigilant about domestic terror groups and international terror groups and our concerns in this country, especially in this time of great political turmoil in our country here, that these folks are now watching overseas and trying to figure out where we are vulnerable. So thanks for listening to Crime Time, where we talk about crime and crooks and cops and personal security, your personal security. We talk about some dangerous people and lots of heroes. We'll even mention a few stupid crooks. We'll talk about what you need to do to keep yourself and your family and your home and your business safe from crime and violence. As always, you need to be vigilant at home and at work and in your neighborhood, in your community, at your kid's school, college campus, at work, and even on the road. This show exists to make you feel more empowered, more secure, and more educated on security issues and the criminal justice system. As background, I worked for the San Diego Police Department for 15 years as a patrol officer, a reserve sergeant, and later as a domestic violence investigator. I now work as a training consultant, teach training workshops, webinars, focusing on human resources and employee coaching, workplace violence, and security issues at work. I've written 24 books on business, workplace violence, police subjects, and guns, all of which you can find on Amazon. My three gun books are available on Amazon Kindle. You can always reach me at my website, crimetimeradio.com. crimetimeradio.com. Send me an email. Connect with me on LinkedIn. And you can find past episodes of the show on SoundCloud and new ones on my YouTube channel as they post each time. So let's talk a little bit about some kind of history of terrorism that we've seen in this country. A lot of stuff involving bombings. Certainly, think about the first World Trade Center bombing in February 93. That was the precursor, the foreshadowing of 9/11, which happened 8 years later in September 01, 9/11, which is, you know, the biggest terrorist event that we've had in the history of the United States, you know, on the same par as Pearl Harbor in 1941. So the first February 93 World Trade Center bombing involved a truck bomb that was put in the World Trade Center parking lot. And you know, the folks in the Clinton administration and the international terrorism and intelligence experts would just did not put the signs together and seeing this as a foreshadowing. And in retrospect, that, you know, they talk about having missed a lot of the warning signs about how this became the precursor, the foreshadowing for 9/11. We look at the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. That took down the federal building, the Mura building there in April of 95. Timothy McVeigh, who was executed for that crime later on. If you have the opportunity and the courage and the guts to go to the Oklahoma City bombing memorial, you should do it. And some time in your life, if you can pass through Oklahoma City on your way to somewhere else, go look at that memorial. I looked at it in about 8 years ago with my police partner, and we went to the outside where I have all these little chairs that represent the pediatric deaths, the kids that were killed in that bombing, next to the adult chairs. And so that's the marker, the symbolism. They use little chairs of dead kids and adult chairs sitting out in this kind of open field next to the building where the site was. And it was so powerful for me, so touching, I couldn't go inside the building. I was looking at the photographs of these little kids and seeing things outside, and I was in tears. I couldn't go inside the building. I said, I can't do this. I can't go and look at this stuff. I was just too raw. I remember talking to a fire chief from the Oklahoma City bombing who responded, and I was on a panel with him on workplace violence a couple years after the event in 95. And he said he would stand in the shadow of the building, as you know, the shell of that building in, at the crime scene, and listen to the building creak, and it was just like out of a horror movie. And so when he would hear at home doors creak, or he would open the dishwasher and it would creak, it would take him back to that time and space, which is just, you know, a horrific sort of an imprint that he had. So the Oklahoma City bombing was really, really a perfect example of good law enforcement work, where a Oklahoma State trooper stopped McVeigh and thought he was suspicious and ended up arresting the guy and getting a good grab of this guy before he could get out of the state or out of the country. Certainly 9/11, huge terrorist event with plenty of planning and plenty of expertise by these people. I mean, they trained themselves to fly, you know, commercial jet airplanes, for God's sakes, and to take over these things and turn them into bombs. And we'd always thought about, in this country, you know, we look at terrorism kind of before 9/11 is not really thinking about a concept called asymmetrical methodology. And asymmetrical methodology says, let us take a plane and turn it into a bomb. And we don't really think about those kind of ways. You know, we think about bombs in this country as part of a terrorist's, you know, toolkit. But to turn a plane into a bomb, or to turn a virus into a terrorist device to release upon the world or the country is asymmetric methodology. We don't usually think in those terms. So when you think of asymmetric methodology, you look at the Vietnam War, where we wore uniforms and the bad guys in Vietnam did not. And when you look at the War on Terror, where we wear uniforms and the bad guys in Iraq and Afghanistan do not, that's an example of asymmetric methodology, which is they hide inside hotel or hospitals and orphanages and places where we wouldn't shoot into the building. So that's asymmetric methodology, that they think outside a different box than we do, especially when it comes to the rules of engagement. So we are sometimes behind the curve because they are always thinking about ways to be more clever, to injure or kill people, to disrupt the government. And oftentimes we don't think about the possibility of those things until they happen. And then we are behind in terms of the methodologies that we have to create to stop them, the things that we have to do in terms of vigilance and equipment and policies and training to stop them. Think about the domestic terrorist activities of a workplace violence or a school violence perpetrator, which is to come in and shoot up a school, come in and shoot up a movie theater, come in and shoot up a mall. And it's an act of domestic terrorism, which is to terrify thousands of people, frighten people, disrupt businesses, put a tremendous strain on our law enforcement and hospital resources. Again, those are examples of this asymmetric methodology. So then we think about a guy like Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. 16 bombs that he created and detonated or you know, set off to detonate themselves, because he was a pretty clever guy about this stuff, from 1978 to 1995. He was arrested in 96 when his brother recognized the language of the manifesto that was published, I think, in the New York Times, which was one of his demands. So he killed 3 people and wounded 24, the Unabomber, and he was sentenced to 6 life terms in prison. We have Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber in Atlanta in 1996. Pretty interesting movie done by Clint Eastwood about that whole situation and the security guard that was railroaded into that, you know, being blamed for that crime. Very worthwhile movie to watch. Then we have the Nashville bomber here, Christmas Day here in 2020, kind of the last, you know, screw you to the year 2020, another horrible event to cover all the horrible events that have happened in 2020. And we look at a guy who has some sort of plan, some sort of approach to this terrorist event. I'm going to blow up a bomb next to an AT&T building in Nashville. I'm going to give warnings to law enforcement, warnings to the people around there to evacuate, which is rare. It's very unusual for these types of perpetrators to do this. They usually take action and then they claim responsibility later on. So very, very rare for this guy to do this, which, you know, I talked about this last week, which my sense is he didn't want to harm that many people. Otherwise, he would have not had that warning, and he would have not put a motorhome with a bomb in it. I guess he was in the motorhome as well. They found parts and pieces of him all over the place. Is the idea that the bombing was done on a deserted street at Christmas Day when the business is closed, or there's a skeleton crew operating inside the AT&T building, don't know. Yet the idea that he wanted to draw attention to whatever his cause was. And so that's the issue that, you know, Chairman Mao talked about so many years ago with terrorism, which is, you know, the idea that it's you know, kill 100 and frighten a million, or words to that effect, is what these people are doing with these car bombs, these car attacks, workplace violence, school violence attacks, which is to terrify a nation, to terrify a country, to try to disrupt the government. So, you know, these days, the groups of people, left-wing and right-wing, I mean, there's just too many to mention. The idea that we have people that are hardened around their racial views, their racial bigotries on the left side and the right side. You know, a lot of the stuff is aimed towards the Jews and the Israelis. A lot of it is aimed towards race. A lot of it is aimed towards the government in any form. And so there's always been, you know, this sort of sedition activity going back, you know, from the 1900s and the early 20th century, where there's always been people that hate the government, no matter what. It doesn't matter who's in charge. And so we go back as citizens of this country and say, it's not about who's the president. It's not about who's in power. It's about protecting our way of life, protecting our liberty, protecting our freedom. So we've had to, I mean, as a result of 9/11, we've created an entire infrastructure called the Department of Homeland Security to now focus our energies and our equipment and people and intelligence under this same umbrella. So, you know, all these disparate groups, the FBI and Secret Service and the Marshals and local law enforcement and state law enforcement and all the, I mean, they've all been folded under this sort of umbrella, either under the umbrella at a federal level for the Department of Homeland Security, but under the state and local level of just our mission is going to be about fighting crime, but also this new task now prior to 9/11, which is terrorism. So think about the shift in our country after 9/11 about people coming into this country with the desire to disrupt us, to kill people and to ruin our way of life is now, you know, maybe it's at an ebb now that it's starting back up again in terms of the awareness part of it because of all the political unrest. But it's been at a kind of a low ebb before this, maybe before Trump got into office, because people's memories fade about 9/11. And so you can talk to people for, you know, based on their age, for they have no sense of what 9/11 was all about. I mean, it happened in 01. My daughter would have been 8 years old. I mean, my daughter's, you know, 27 now. And so you say, what was her memory of that event at 8 years old? What would be your memory of any event at 8 years old? I mean, even the death of a, you know, a relative at 8 years old is a hard thing to remember. You know, grandpa dies when you're eight. I mean, you can remember the details a little bit as to what happened and that you were sad, but the sort of impact of that thing 20 years forward is not the same, certainly. And I don't expect that people will, you know, wake up every day and you know, think about the survivors of 9/11, wake up every day and go, oh my God, I'm still alive. I'm sure they do that. I don't think everybody in the country has to think about 9/11 24/7. I don't expect people to obsess over safety and security. I obsess over safety and security. I think about 9/11 survivors and 9/11 victims all the time. But we do have to have a place in our hearts where we go, that happened, and we can't forget it. We have to have a place in our hearts that says, that happened, and as a result, we need to be more vigilant. And as a result, we need to change our perspective to say, not that it might happen again, but that, and we need to be paranoid about it, but that it could happen. And that many small tasks and things in terms of intelligence gathering and surveillance that terrorists use can be interrupted by smart people paying attention. It can be interrupted by people in our communities, you and I, who are vigilant and who have the courage with a capital C to go, that doesn't seem right. And maybe I need to tell the FBI. And we'll talk about, you know, 1-800-CALL-FBI. I mean, couldn't be any easier than that. 1-800-CALL-CALL-FBI. And you know, there's a sort of a sense, I think sometimes, of the pretty girl that doesn't get invited to the prom because everybody thinks she gets so many invitations that why bother to ask her. And I think there's a sense, you know, as you're driving down the highway and you see a car fire and you say, well, someone's probably already called the state police or the highway patrol. I don't need to do it. Right? Somebody had already done that. And betwixt that time, the car burns up because nobody called. So, you know, I have done a lot of training just recently for some of my clients about mandated reporter for child abuse. And sometimes people say, well, why do I need to call? Because I don't want to get involved. It's not my business. And then the other thing they say is, well, somebody else has probably called. And I always say the same thing in that discussion with mandated reporting for child abuse or just being a human being, is that you say, okay, maybe what I contribute to the investigation is important. Maybe what I contribute to the people taking the report, the social workers and the people that are running these hotlines for the counties, maybe what I say to them fills in a gap for them, fills in a puzzle piece for them, reminds them of or identifies something for them that they can go forward with the investigation. So you provide another tile, so to speak, that fills in the mosaic, which gives them the total picture. So it's the same thing with the feds. It's the same thing with local law enforcement or state law enforcement. We call to report things that an intuitive, reasonable person, not somebody who's profiling somebody or you know, being a bigot, but somebody who's reasonable person would say, that seems unusual. That seems like surveillance activity. That seems like a guy's making machine guns or bombs in his garage. The idea that we have the courage with a capital C to report that stuff sometimes just fills in the rest of the pieces for the feds or whoever that's investigating this to go, okay, now we can take action because now we have enough information. Before we did not. So that's why we do that stuff. You have to have the courage to know when it is to respond to your intuition. You have to have some sense of awareness, which means get your head out of your phone and pay attention, and you're not spying on folks. We're not you know, drilling holes in people's walls and looking at them with, you know, small cameras, but we're just paying attention to stuff. And sometimes these domestic terrorist perpetrators or international terrorist perpetrators make mistakes, and they do stupid stuff, which we identify, and the cops can swoop in and grab these folks before bad things happen. I'm remembering a case, and this kind of dates back to post 9/11, but you know, not too far forward from 9/11, where a group of these Middle Eastern men were taking photographs at Fort Dix, New Jersey, the army base there in Fort Dix. I think my dad was at Fort Dix for a while. So at the Fort Dix base, they were taking pictures of the fencing and the guards and the army base, you know, protocols there. And, you know, like idiots, they turned the photos in at Walgreens or some drugstore to have the photos developed. Well, some guy who's doing the developing says, well, here's a bunch of Middle Eastern cats standing around pointing at things that are at an army base. That seems unusual. I mean, again, we're not going on bigotry and skin color here. We're going on behavior, which is a big difference, right? We focus on behavior, not what people look like. I don't care what people look like. I care what they do. White, black, Middle Eastern, Asian. I don't care what you look like. I care what you do, right? Behavior is the focus that we want to pay attention to. And this guy reported that stuff to the FBI. Well, short story long, FBI investigates, goes in, arrests these guys, bomb-making materials, rifles, shotguns, all kinds of guns. They're going to attack Fort Dix, New Jersey Army base. Well, the cops, the FBI swooped in and stopped them before they could do that. Why? Based on the wisdom of a guy developing color photographs in a little booth in a Walgreens in New Jersey. It takes that kind of courage to do the right thing based on what you see. A reasonable person, not a psychologist, not a criminal profiler, not a cop, not a lawyer, not a social scientist, but a reasonable person would go, that seems unusual. I got to tell the FBI. I got to tell local cops about it and see what happens. So I have heard stories from people who have talked to me and said, you know, I saw these sketchy looking dudes and they were doing X, Y, and Z, and I told the cops and they didn't do anything about it. And I go, well, okay, thanks for doing that. It means that's what citizens do. We, you know, we don't spy on people, but we report stuff which seems dangerous or moving towards danger. And questions I always ask is, well, how do you know nothing happened? How do you know the cops didn't do anything? Well, because I didn't see the guys, you know, get arrested later on. I go, well, how do you know that something didn't happen as a result of what you did? Lots of stuff, as we know, takes place within the vacuum of law enforcement where there's not a obvious sort of, you know, raid where guys in raid jackets show up and haul away a bunch of people and boxes and weapons and computers. That doesn't always happen, the stuff we see on TV. Some things get investigated quietly. Some things get investigated with, you know, a top secret sort of a connection to them. We don't always know what happened. But that shouldn't stop you from making the report if you think it's something they need to know about. So if you look at situations in life that we report things to law enforcement, sometimes it can be identified and verified and checked off within context to say, okay, no big deal, and it's not a situation or a thing we need to get more involved in. We checked it out, no big deal. Some things that are not within context, that don't make sense, that are not reasonable for that situation, turn into an investigation which somebody ends up getting arrested or deported or sent to jail or whatever. So it's not our function to say, I wonder if I should tell the cops, and I wonder what the cops are going to do. We just say, this seems unusual. It's connected to a surveillance activity. It's connected to one of these 15 things I'll talk about, and I got to do something about it. I got to tell the cops. If they take steps, great. If they don't, their problem. At least we say, I did the right thing as a citizen in this country. There is a group that the FBI created after 9/11 called InfraGard, InfraGard. It's not spelled you know, with a guard like the usual way. It's InfraGard, InfraGard.org. InfraGard is a partnership between private sector businesses, not government businesses, but private sector businesses, and the FBI. So there are 56 field offices for the FBI around the United States. Various and sundry big cities have field offices. And then they have satellite offices where, you know, agents work out of other smaller towns and communities on certain investigations. But there are lots of InfraGard chapters in the United States. And so if you are a private sector business, and especially if you work in any kind of connection to a business where there might be a terrorism concern, like you manufacture fertilizer or bullets or you are a cyber company, a cyber cyber crime prevention company. You provide, you know, resources to people to stop hacking and ransomware and things like that. If you have a type of business which could be targeted by terrorists, if you have the type of business where you could be interacting with people with suspicious, you know, characteristics, being involved with InfraGuard says you can tell the FBI, here's what's going on, and these chapter meetings where we talk about this stuff, and the FBI gives within the boundaries of what they can release in terms of top secret information, they, you know, unclassified information, they give briefings at these InfraGuard meetings to people, business leaders, business community members about what's going on and to keep this country safe. So it is another example of networking the resources around the United States of business owners, especially those ones that may have some sort of connection to a type of operation, type of manufacturing operation or a business operation, which could be a target for terrorism. But you could say, you know, I work for a real estate office. Can we be a member of InfraGuard? Sure. It's all about awareness, and it's all about awareness building, where you see things and your business neighbors see things, which end up being something that you report to the FBI as a way to say, this seems unusual, you guys got to take a look at it. So let's look at some of the warning signs for suspicious activities. I have 15 here. There are certainly more. But when we look at some of these things, we go back to sort of the main message, which is protect your country by, you know, the mantra which we have always seen, which is see something, say something. Well, you know, the idea that we can report to the FBI, we can report to specific law enforcement agencies, we can call our local sheriff's department or PD. And I think sometimes you may need to be, especially if you don't call 1-800-CALL-FBI, 225-5324, that's the 800 number, 225-5324. If you don't call the FBI and you call local law enforcement, you may get a dispatcher, you may get a secretary, you may get some cop who's on light duty for a back injury. And so you may need to be pretty, what's the word I'm looking for, concise and focused on telling your story as to what you saw, and asking them to take as much information as you can give them so that they can do something about it. Now, you know, screening in these types of phone calls is critical, because someone says, it sounds like BS, or there's nothing to worry about. You know, I always say, well, could you pass it up the line? Could you at least, you know, notify your bosses? Could you at least notify the patrol captain? Or could you at least notify, you know, somebody in the federal law enforcement? And that's by calling the FBI or the Secret Service or, you know, U.S. Marshals. If you have tips about people or situations or events, you know, at least at the federal level, it's going to get investigated. You look at events connected to the Nashville bombing on Christmas, you can guess how many tips, hundreds of tips, came into the ATF and local law enforcement and the FBI about investigating this guy so that they can put together a composite and a profile of what this guy was all about, who did this event, this bombing. This happens because they can maximize the resources. And remember, on a past show, I had Chris Holland, who is a retired FBI agent, said, you know, the FBI can stop on a dime and put 4,000 agents on one event like they did in, you know, Atlanta Olympic bombing. They can put 4,000 agents on one event at the drop of a hat. So they have tremendous resources in the federal level to do certain things based on the information that they get. So let's talk about some of these warning signs. Aviation activity is one of the warning signs. Somebody operating drones, or if you see, and you know, guys have done this, they've rented airplanes, or they've rented pilots, or they've rented helicopters, or they've rented helicopter pilots to fly around and take pictures of stuff. And maybe it's just another gig to the helicopter pilot, but maybe it's something that the helicopter pilot sees and says, well, this is unusual. These guys keep wanting to fly around this electrical power grid, or want to fly around this water treatment station or something like that. So drones in itself is not a terrorist activity, obviously. We're talking about context here. But if you see drones flying over a resource like a police station or an electrical power plant or a certain type of business where you go, well, that seems unusual that they would do that. Maybe that's something that we pay attention to. Maybe that's something that you report. It certainly could be measured within context and go, no, that's a real estate guy, and he's taking photographs for his client because he's selling the warehouse. No big deal. But sometimes you go, that seems unusual that they're focusing on a certain type of flying a drone around a certain type of business. Surveillance is probably the biggest one. And if we see evidence of surveillance, This is people sitting in cars. This is people with binoculars taking pictures, videos. There's not a usual reason for people to be clandestine in those types of activities. If you're taking pictures of a house for a real estate ad, I mean, you get out and you put up signs and you're posing people and you're moving things around, and it seems like obvious context that's what you're doing. We're talking about folks sitting in cars and vans and trucks and campers and RVs that are taking photographs, videos, measuring things, seem to be writing stuff down that you're like, well, that seems unusual. They're only taking videos when the security guard comes out to the front gate. Evidence of surveillance towards a business, especially a critical business, whether they're going to target a police station or they're targeting a utility, they're targeting a company that does network, provides IT systems, things like that. Those are the targets, and that's oftentimes terrorist behavior is preceded by surveillance. There's a breach, something that security guards catch a guy trying to do a break-in or catch a group of guys trying to break into a certain target. There's an attempted intrusion, attempted breach, where these guys are trying to either make a test run to see when the big day happens, or they're just trying to get in to steal information or steal equipment or get things that may help them. So imagine the type of equipment that these guys might want to steal for terrorism. They break into an excavation company to steal dynamite. They break into a company that manufactures poisons. They break into a gun dealer. They break into a company that they can steal laptops, tablets, cell phones, things like that. Those are the types of things that these guys break into. Acquisition of expertise. That's an interesting kind of a thing post 9/11. These guys, these terrorists went to, the 19, they went to, several of them, they went to flight schools and said, I want to learn how to fly jets. And so, I mean, imagine the training you have to go through, from private pilot's license to multi-engine license to jets. I mean, there's a lot of work. I mean, this is not a, I'm going to do this over the weekend thing. This is a concerted effort over several years to get the training necessary to be able to fly a passenger airliner into a building, or a passenger airliner into the Pentagon, or a passenger airliner in over Pennsylvania. So it's not, again, we're not profiling people. We're not targeting people based on race or religion or anything like that. We're looking at behavior and saying, why would somebody in the 9/11 context, I mean, if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, which is a fascinating book, and it reads like a spy novel. I mean, it's been almost 20 years, but it reads like a spy novel. If you read the 9/11 Commission report, there's some sense that when these guys went to flight training school, they told the trainers, I just want to learn how to fly the plane. I don't want to have to take off or land. You don't have to teach me to take off or land. Now, if you're a pilot, wouldn't you say, well, that's unusual? Especially in the light of 9/11, you would say that's example of acquisition of expertise, which is concerning to us. So we have breaching or attempted intrusion. We have surveillance. We have aviation activity. Eliciting information. So asking questions about security, asking questions about security devices and protocols and procedures. Asking questions about when the security guards change shifts and what kind of guns these cops carry. Things like that normal people don't typically ask questions or take notes about. Sometimes these people are so obvious in their eliciting information that it sets off a warning sign for us. Why would these folks be asking questions about when the armored car gets here? Why would these people be asking, these strangers be asking questions about how often the police come by? Stuff like that. Again, all this stuff goes back to context. If it's contextually reasonable, no big deal. You're not calling the FBI for that. If it's contextually unreasonable and it sets off an intuition thing that seems unusual to you, then that's when you make the call. Misrepresentation. This is a concern to me. We've seen people wear uniforms, police uniforms, military uniforms. We've seen people dress like delivery drivers. We've seen people wear other types of uniforms where you would say, oh, that must be the delivery person who's coming here, and it's not the actual guy. So misrepresentation, they impersonate various and sundry groups or people, authority figures, things like that, in order to get access or to get information. Certainly, cyber attack is a significant concern for us. And cyber attacks these days are so related to disruption of our internet services in this country, disruption of services, denial of services that are coming from these nation states that are good at this type of stuff. You know, former Soviet bloc countries and places overseas that are really good at knocking down and hacking into our systems. I mean, I think the most recent one I just heard about was some hackers tapped into Parler, which is the sort of Twitter equivalent, and got access to photographs that people sent to Parler, the fronts and backs of their driver's license, in order to be a verified user of Parler. So now they've got access to, I don't know the number, a lot, many thousands of Parler accounts, some of which have their driver's license on front and back. Well, imagine you've got, you know, the driver's license of a news media professional, or the driver's license of a cop, or driver's license of a political person, as part of this hack. So cyber attacks for terrorism is really about a lot of things. One is disrupting services. The other is gathering information. And also, certainly we know from cyber attacks that gathering information, especially hacking into accounts, is a financial reward for these groups. And so, you know, a lot of times we look at how these people are funded, and maybe they're funded by drug sales, and maybe they're funded by the nation state themselves funds them, and maybe they're funded by their activities that they do as a result of cyber terrorism and cyber attacks. Recruiting. Certainly a big issue where people go into religious organizations, or they go into groups or associations that are left-wing or right-wing and try to recruit. We saw this in the skinhead movement for the KKK. We saw this in left-wing and right-wing groups connected to especially American Nazi Party in the United States, things like that, where there's recruiting going on all the time, where they're trying to get new members, they're trying to get new money, they're trying to get new support, they're trying to get new guns, they're trying to get new sort of recruits that buy into their twisted way of life so they can go off and harm other folks. Certainly, sabotage, vandalism, tampering. We've seen people, you know, cutting the fence at water utilities. We've seen people, you know, climbing over the fence and trying to pour things into reservoirs and lakes. We've seen people trying to get into locked storage facilities where chemicals are stored or explosives are stored. We've certainly seen people breaking into gun stores. We've seen vandalism and sabotage connected to sort of this boundary probing and testing and that type of thing, so that they can see what our response is as a law enforcement response or a firefighting response. Another one would be theft or a loss or some type of diversion in one part of the community, which creates an opportunity to steal at another part of the community. I mean, if I'm a smart terrorist, I rob five banks in five different parts of a large city. I mean, big bank takeovers, like, you know, guys come in with shotguns or automatic weapons and semi-autos and take over a bank and, you know, tell everybody to get down and get as much money as possible and do that five times at the exact same moment. And think about in cities like New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and Atlanta and places where there's tremendous traffic. I mean, if you set a diversion, just watch some of the Batman movies for examples of how they do this. If you caused accidents at certain parts of the city, in certain key areas while you were doing a bank robbery, the police couldn't get there. I mean, think about how hard it is to get across one part of Los Angeles to another, even on surface streets. And so if you were able to stage accidents with buses or semi-trucks or vans or things like that, where you're blocking key intersections and key access points onto the highway and you're doing bank robberies at the same time, a tremendous, tremendous chaos that you would create. So that's part of their world as well, theft, loss, and diversion. Threats, and sometimes the issue for us is not the expressed threats, I'm going to blow up the building, but the implied threats, which is people say things like, you haven't heard the last of me, or this isn't going to end well, stuff like that we need to pay attention to. These are related in the work that I do to workplace violence threats, school violence threats, threats to employers, you know, post-termination, threats to harm people that we have employed or students. You know, there's kind of a two different types of people who make threats. One group is we call howlers. They draw attention to themselves. They try to be provocative. Their function is to be larger than life and to scare people. Those are not the folks that typically act out. They're not the folks that typically strike. The ones that concern me are the hunters. Hunters are people who work in stealth. Hunters are people, and I mean, think in the real life, how do hunters function, right? They put on camouflage and face paint and they crawl around the woods and they shoot Bambi, right? The idea that hunters work in stealth says they don't make express threats. They make implied threats. They don't threaten the target directly. They may leak information to third parties about harming the target. Those are the things we have to have the courage to report. There is an exception to the mantra that howlers don't hunt and hunters don't howl, which is domestic violence. And in those situations, when somebody says, I'm going to kill my ex-wife, or I'm going to kill my current girlfriend, or I'm going to kill this woman who broke my heart, we pay really careful attention to that because those people lash out. And you know the mantra there, which is, if I can't have you, nobody else can. So expressed threats are certainly a concern and a warning sign. But from my perspective and from the terrorism prevention perspective, we're looking at implied threats, which is we hear leakage. We hear someone leak information to another person at a bar or a restaurant or at some kind of activity or a meeting or something in the community that we hear where one person leaks what they're going to do to somebody else. Now, why do perpetrators and terrorism and violence, why would they leak information? Sometimes they can't help it. They just want to tell somebody. Sometimes they want to recruit or develop more information, or they think this person's going to help them get their task accomplished. And the other reason they do it is because sometimes they're testing as to what this person's response will be. Are you going to go tell the cops on me? Are you going to help me in what I'm trying to do, etc.? So threats are a big part of this. Eliciting information. So terrorist intelligence groups, especially people that have counterintelligence and intelligence training, are good at social engineering. So they can call a company and figure out a way to get the passwords to get into the mainframe system. And this happens all the time. People reveal stuff over the phone. They reveal stuff over the internet. They reveal stuff on emails that they get questions for. Good terrorist activities, especially related to cybercrime, are really good at gathering information from people as to what they're trying to do. Materials acquisition and storage. And so you think about terrorist activities. They've got to store bomb-making devices. They have to store bomb-making equipment. They have to store fertilizer, or they have to store gasoline. They store propane tanks. They store things that are related to firearms and weapons and things like that. So a second piece connected to that is weapons collections and storage. And we're not talking about people that own guns. We're talking about people that are stockpiling people that are stockpiling guns, stockpiling ammunition, stockpiling weapons in a way that's designed to harm the federal government or harm the state government or harm a school or a workplace. And not just people that own guns, obviously, but people that are doing it in such a way where there's a mass group of guys that are putting together a mass group of weapons and or bomb-making activity. Sort of a smaller sort of example of that is, and I think it was in Ohio, there was a kid who was a school kid, and I think he was 16 or 17. He actually rented a storage facility, which, you know, you got to give him credit for having the wherewithal to move his bomb-making activities out of his garage. He rented a storage facility, and he was actually working on making bombs where this woman was walking by the storage facility, and there was a fence, a chain-link fence. She was walking her dog, and she looked over and saw this kid monkeying around with stuff that looked like bomb-making stuff. I mean, like pipe bombs. So she looks at that. She ends up telling the cops. The cops go over there. They sneak and peek. They come up there and they nab this kid. And he's got a storage facility with an open door, full of bomb making activities. He's going to blow up his school. So you know, the parents are like, well, he was tinkering with something in the garage, and then we didn't see it anymore, which means he moved it. You know, the collection of materials there, to another place where he could work in peace while he made these bombs to blow up his school. So imagine these types of activities at a larger scale, bomb-making activities, weapons collection, weapons storage for these guys that are getting ready to harm a federal target, harm a local target. And then the last one is sort of a sector-specific incident, which is they go after certain types of facilities that they have targeted, which could be utilities, it could be IT, it could be water, it could be, think about where we are most vulnerable. A trucking company that delivers to a huge warehouse facility for food that we take down. These guys are attempting to take down places where we store lots of things that we need for food service and things like that, where there's a sector-specific incident where they target, whether it's a private sector company or a public government company that provides services to people, to shut down the city, to shut down the nation. So when we look at these activities here, these 15 things, it's all about what fits in context and what it seems unusual to you. I'm not asking you to be an FBI profiler. I'm asking you, if you see something in a reasonable person, not a psychologist or a cop or a lawyer or a social scientist, but a reasonable person would say, that seems unusual. I'm going to tell somebody. 1-800-CALL-FBI is our perfect choice. So if we see something, say something. The idea of paying attention to those types of warning signs, the things that you say, that seems unusual and it's keeping me up at night. I have to have the courage to tell local law enforcement. If you think it's related to terrorism, you call the FBI, 1-800-CALL-FBI, and you make your report. That's what reasonable citizens do. That's what people do to protect this country and our way of life from domestic or international terrorism activities. So one of my favorite parts of the show now, Crime Time's Stupidest Crook of the Week. Here's where I get to talk about some of our dumbest criminals who managed to get themselves arrested based on their monumental stupidity. Okay, a Connecticut woman, 64 years old, was arrested for driving while under the influence of alcohol, and she was headed to the liquor store where she was arrested again. I think it was about 5 hours difference between the time, the first arrest and the second arrest happened about a 5 hour difference. 64-year-old woman in Connecticut crashes her Lexus sedan into a parked car at 2:30 in the afternoon. Police smell alcohol in her breath. She is given a field sobriety test, and she's taken to the police station. She blows a blood alcohol level of 0.23. Now, 0.8 is the national arrest level for blood alcohol for drunk driving. She's at 2.3, three times the legal limit. That's a lot of booze. She's charged with DUI and possession of a controlled substance for a painkiller that was discovered in her purse. 6 hours later, she's arrested. She heads to a liquor store. The cops pull her over again after she leaves the liquor store. She blows into the blood alcohol thing again, the intoxilizer, and her blood alcohol level was 0.09, still above the legal limit. So she had to have drank, you know, on the way to six hours. You can still be pretty drunk. She may have drunk, probably, on the way to the liquor store, the way home from the liquor store, and then get pulled over by the cops. So she's a 2.3, and then 6 hours later, she's an 0.09. So taken to jail for drunk driving, second time in one day. That's an expensive arrest. The average drunk driving arrest is like ballpark $8,000 to $15,000 in terms of fees and court costs and attorneys, depending on what city or county you're in. So two of those is a little expensive. I would argue this woman has an issue, no shock here, with alcohol. My partner and I in San Diego arrested a guy for domestic violence twice in one day, twice in one shift. We worked 10-hour shifts. We arrested the guy about an hour into the shift, and he made bail. About 7 hours later, we arrested him a second time for hitting his girlfriend. She let him back into the house the second time. She actually bailed him out of jail. So he hit her once, and then about 7 hours later, we arrested him for hitting her again. So it is possible to get arrested twice in one day for all kinds of things. Let's test your Crime Time IQ with this week's Crime Quiz question for Crime Time. Who portrayed the first police officers in the American movies? Who portrayed the first cops in the American movies? The Keystone Cops, often spelled Keystone with a K and Cops with a K, are fictional, humorously incompetent policemen featured in silent film slapstick comedies produced by Max Sennett for his Keystone film comedies. The first one was in 1913. They were created as film characters for the silent movies in 1912 and appeared in a movie in 1913. And they ran a collection of goofball comedies, which were the biggest, along with the biggest movie stars of the day, Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and those folks. And the Keystone Cops ran from 1913 until 1917. So the first cops portrayed on the big screen were the Keystone Cops in 1913. This week's Crime Time safety tip is all about the IRS. It's important to remember that the IRS will never contact any taxpayer by email or by telephone. It's a scam. If you get stuff by email or by telephone, it is a scam. They're trying to get your Social Security number or get you to pay some sort of a fee. It is a scam. They will always contact you by U.S. mail, and you cannot email, and I know this from example, you cannot email the IRS. They will not correspond with you by email. They'll send you certified letters that you have to sign for, but they'll never call you at home or work asking you for money. They'll never send you emails asking for money or to sign on or to create an account or to give up your personal information. So do not look at or open any emails that come from the, quote, IRS. They're not coming from there. Don't answer any telephone calls that come from scammers supposedly to be the IRS. That's not how the IRS contacts you. So thanks for listening to this episode of Crime Time. I encourage you to go to my website at crimetimeradio.com. Send me an email with questions or topics you want me to cover on future shows. Connect with me on LinkedIn at Dr. Steve Albrecht. I no longer have a Twitter account. Just contact me on LinkedIn or at crimetimeradio.com. in our world. There are sheep and shepherds and wolves, and too many people are sheep and too few people are shepherds. There are lots of wolves out there. There are not enough police officers or sheriff's deputies to protect us all. You need to be a shepherd. Take care of yourself and protect your family, your loved ones, your friends, and your coworkers. Pay attention and be prepared to defend yourself with legal force if necessary. Be a good witness for the police if you see a crime. Stay safe and aware and alert at home, at work, at school, and even on the road. Thanks for listening to Crime Time. My thanks to Jim Wining, producer Matt, and all the good folks at Axe Media Group. I'm Steve Albrecht. Thanks for listening to what I know is